Vacation Bible School just over, as you have probably guessed, and the children singing in church this morning. I thought about the 10-year-old whose mom asked him what he had learned in class. He said, "Well, our teacher told us today about when God sent Moses behind the enemy lines to rescue the Israelites from the Egyptians. When they came to the Red Sea, Moses called for the engineers to build a pontoon bridge. And after they had all crossed, they looked back and saw the Egyptian tanks coming. Quick as a flash, Mom, Moses radioed headquarters on his walkie-talkie to send bombers to blow up the bridge. And this is how he saved the Israelites." His startled mother said, "Bobby, is that really the way your teacher told the story?" He said, "Well, not exactly, but if I told it her way, you'd never believe it." I had a poem by Christopher Morley printed on the back page of your program this morning, just in case you care to read the lines again on some especially frantic day. I picked that poem because it offers such a stark contrast to the sermon title, "Hurry, Hurry, Hurry," which sounds like the spiel of a carnival barker and is what you're likely to hear when life is most like a carnival: gaudy, hot, noisy, here today, gone tomorrow-ish. I don't expect all of you to notice that it's a Petrarchan sonnet with a very demanding rhyme scheme, or even that in typical fashion it states the proposition in the first 8 lines and provides a resolution in the last 6. In fact, I wouldn't even mention this since you're in church and not in your old college English class, except that you appreciate so much more what the author has done if you know the strict discipline of form through which he has to express himself. I discovered a long time ago that if I had students try to write a sonnet, either in Italian like this one or a Shakespearean, they came out of that exhausting experience with a great deal more respect for someone who could play by all the self-imposed rules and still say something beautifully profound, or in the case of this poem, catchy and sensible. End of college English class, except that I do want to read it aloud. "Quiet is what we need. By telephone, the press, the mail, the doorbell, radio, AP, or NAM, or CIO, we're micro-organized and overgrown with everybody's business but our own. Pipe it down, chain talkers. Muffle and slow the rapid pulse. I wonder if you know how good it feels sometimes to be alone. Incessantly loquacious generation, let yea and nay be your communication. Before the world comes open at the seams, invest some private enterprise in dreams. In unimpassioned silence, we might find, if ever, what the author had in mind." Now, if we were in an English class together, I would not be able to resist pointing out how the multisyllabic words "incessantly loquacious generation" sound like someone who can't stop talking. You don't think so, do you? "Incessantly loquacious generation." It just goes on. Well, there were days like this in class, too. And then how they are played off against those one-syllable words right out of the Bible, yes and no, I think it's a nice touch. But since we are out of college and in church, I won't mention it. But I do recommend with some urgency that you and I take the advice of this minor poet as well as the advice of a much better one, Carl Sandburg, who reminds us that one of the greatest necessities in America is to discover creative solitude. He would have appreciated the Broadway comedy years ago with the intriguing title, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. Most people I know have that feeling sometimes, but it's spinning so fast we're afraid to step off for fear it may do us in. We just hang on tightly, grit our teeth, put up with the pace and the racket, and hope for the best. It may be a dubious comfort to you, but at least the problem is not new. One day, the disciples of Christ came back to tell him all they had done and taught on their tour of duty. And the story says there were so many people coming and going that Jesus and his disciples didn't even have time to eat. So he said to them, "Let's go off by ourselves to some place where we will be alone and you can rest for a while." A prescription for physical and psychic rest from the master of living. You need to be quiet for a while. I think we have to remind ourselves that if we fail to do that, we fail the one we profess to follow. And if those words in Mark's gospel give a picture of breathless life, if there was coming and going in those little villages of Palestine, think how multiplied it is in our cities with comings and goings by bus and car, plane and train, life so public and so incessantly in motion that it's like living in some enormous railroad station. There really are days when some people barely have time to eat. I remember a man by the name of Paul Logue, whom I knew in St. Louis, a vice president for Monsanto, a wonderful friend to me, and perhaps the most gracefully dignified man I have ever known. A man who, in his busy office, spoke the same greeting into the telephone all day long, incessantly, until he must have felt sometimes that he had turned into a robot. One night he rushed home late, where his wife and two sons were patiently waiting for him. By then, some half hour past their dinner time, Paul collapsed into his chair, knowing that they had waited to have him say grace before the meal. He bowed his head, opened his mouth, and found the day was still with him. What he said was, Logue speaking, Paul made a decision after that. He furnished a small room in his lovely English half-timbered house to be a meditation place, to be used for nothing else, and to be used regularly. He'd stop there for a few minutes before he went to work in the morning. He would visit that room again in the evenings. He told me that his life took on new depth and greater serenity after that. And I remember reading a National Newsweekly story some years ago about an eminent Japanese industrialist, head of a multi-million-dollar empire that was growing so fast you wondered how anyone could keep up with it. And there was a picture I have never forgotten, of that businessman sitting on a small rug with his legs crossed and his head slightly bowed. The caption explained that each morning he got up early enough to sit for 1 hour in absolute quiet. I remember thinking how his Buddhist discipline surpassed that of most Christians I knew, including me, despite the fact that our own religion insists over and over on the need for solitude and meditation to feed the inner life. Because there has to be a lonely place, a refuge from crowding. There is a modern short story, fantasy, about a man who vanished into thin air the minute everyone else left the room. The story's point is that his identity depended absolutely on others. In solitude, he simply did not exist. He was John Smith and Company. And some of us have learned to be that way. We have avoided solitude so long, it terrifies us. Some of you who date far back with me in church life in Wichita may remember a young man named Craig Reynolds who was ordained to ministry in another church. Part of that process required an interrogation session for which I happened to be present that day, and in which, right at the last, somebody asked Craig what he would do if he suddenly had a day free in a busy ministry with nothing to do from 7 to 7. Craig was very young and wanted to please, so he said what I would have said at his age, that he would spend that day in visitations and pastoral ministry and reading as usual, except that he would do even more of it with this unexpected gift of time. Well, I haven't seen him since, but I hope he would answer that question differently now. Like this: gentlemen, if I had been spending months on the job, as your question implies, and I got this day off as a special gift with no duties, I'd go away somewhere to be alone and find myself again. I'd restore my own soul in the conviction that unless I possessed it, I could not be much help to others. It takes some maturity and courage to say that to someone who thinks we ought to be everlastingly busy. Ann Morrow Lindbergh, in a book I know many of you have read, her Gift from the Sea, put it better than anyone. If one sets aside time for a business appointment, a trip to the hairdresser, a social engagement, or a shopping expedition, that time is accepted as inviolable. But if one says, I cannot come because that is my hour to be alone, one is considered rude, egotistical, or strange. What a commentary on our civilization when being alone is considered suspect, when one has to apologize for it, make excuses, hide the fact that one practices it like a secret vice. How would it be, do you think, if you called me and said, Bob, hi, what are you doing? And I were to answer, well, I'm meditating in creative solitude. You know, I have to do that or have nothing to say to you on these occasions. But you and I both know that a more useful answer might be, oh, I've been counseling, writing letters, making phone calls. I'd be nervous to list in my day's schedule a time for solitude, even when I know that the reservoir runs dry without it. I think back again a couple of thousand years and remember Pliny, the old Roman man of letters, urbane and sophisticated, escaping from the fret of Rome to his quiet home among the hills to let the sky have its way with him for a while, saying to us across the centuries, "It builds up the pillars of the mind." But we really don't even have to put that good a face on it. Jesus did not say on the occasion I mentioned that his disciples needed to do creative thinking. He just said, "Gentlemen, you need a rest." Simple as that. No other excuses needed. Louis Fisher, who wrote A Life of Gandhi, asked him in 1942 what lay behind his famous day of silence. And Gandhi said, "It happened when I was being torn to pieces. I was working very hard, traveling in hot trains, incessantly speaking at many meetings and being approached in trains and elsewhere by thousands of people who asked questions, made pleas, and wanted to pray with me. I wanted to rest for one day a week. So I instituted the day of silence. Later, of course, I clothed it with all sorts of virtues and gave it a spiritual cloak, but the motivation was really nothing more than that I needed to have a day off." He would have understood this wise advice from Khalil Gibran, a poet from Christ's own country, about incessant motion and those who chatter too much. He said, "You talk when you cease to be at peace with your thoughts, and when you can no longer dwell in the solitude of your heart. You live in your lips, and sound is a diversion and a pastime." And then he gives us what may be the key to why we fear being alone, why we will not escape from noise and hurry to meditate. "The silence of aloneness reveals to your eyes your naked selves, and you would escape. Escape to the party, the crowd, the bar, the big game, and forever, if there is no other escape, to the television set. Anything to avoid being alone with one's own thoughts." Put over against that the Apostle Paul's terse advice to the people of Thessalonica in Greece, "Aspire to live quietly." City people, especially, might ask themselves at times, "When did I last actually hear the footsteps of the morning, the hush of sunset, unspoiled by my own or my neighbor's lawnmower, the rustle of wind through a wheat field, the sound of my inner self?" I only had to drive a few miles west twice last week to be on gravel roads with no traffic, surrounded on all sides by miles and miles of waving golden wheat. Such moments saved my life. The people who lived in the ancient city of Shechem had a legend that in the silence of the night, they could hear music from a deeply buried stream flowing under their city. And I read that as a parable of our lives. Who knows what lost music of self one might hear if we could be quiet. One of the unforgettable lines in the Psalms is this one: "Be still and know that I am God." If that really is an essential way to finding God, no wonder he's lost in the clutter and din of modern life. I like something said long ago by Marjorie Kemp, 13th century mystic, who imagines God as saying, "If you wear a hair shirt and fast on bread and water, if you say 1,000 Our Fathers every day, you will not please me so well as you do when you are in silence and you allow me to speak to your soul." She had learned, I suppose, what Jesus knew when, before he began his public ministry, he went into the wilderness for a long time of reflection, and what Paul knew when, before he became a church builder and missionary, he went out into the silence of the Arabian desert. They began, in modern slang, by going into solitude to get it all together, and they went back from time to time to keep it together. You know, we treasure that remark in Scripture that no man ever spake quite the way Jesus did, but we ought to remember equally that no man was ever so powerfully silent. All his words were born out of silences, out of times apart for lonely prayer in which he communed with the eternal. I wonder if early in his life he found the words of that ancient Hebrew song and believed them: "Be still and know that I am God." I always preach in hope of converting myself to whatever truth may be in the sermon. So I speak it first of all to myself, knowing how hard it has been for me to make creative pauses. But if you need to overhear it, if you have lost yourself so much in busyness that you never meditate, never commune in solitude, then please join me in welcoming the words of Christ: "Come apart for a while and rest."